We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The book What Color Is Your Parachute is a classic. It's helped generations of job seekers. Now the author has written a new, much shorter and less expensive guide covering the essentials of looking for and landing a job in these very tough economic times. It's called the Job Hunter's Survival Guide. It's 100 pages long. This afternoon, I invite your questions for the author of What Color Is Your Parachute and the Job Hunter's Survival Guide, Richard Nelson Bowles. Our discussion today is part of our summer-long project, Will Connect the Economy. WILL held community conversations on the economy in Champaign, Macon, and Vermilion counties this summer. We've been turning what we've heard, what we've learned into special reports and programming to connect people to one another and to area resources for help. We thank our community partners, First Call for Help Decatur, United Way of Danville, Family Service of Champaign County, and Community Service Center Rantoul. You'll find contact information for these agencies and others at our website, willconnect.org/economy. To begin our conversation this afternoon, we have a story from AM 580 news reporter Jeff Bossert. In central Illinois, many employers, large and small, have downsized or closed altogether, forcing thousands of laid-off workers to consider new options. In this report, Jeff looks at the retraining of workers. Ingenuity and government-funded training are giving many of them a jump on a new career or a better shot at an old one.
Signs of the recession can be found in every corner of the region, but local hairstylists say they're among the exceptions.
When times are hard, you have to find ways to make ends meet in terms of, so far as haircutting. It goes all the way back to Chicago where, you know, my father said, you know, I can't pay for this haircut. Somebody got to do it. So I picked it up and I learned how to do it, and I taught him how to do it while I was doing it as well.
Ray Ansong comes to Champaign from Ghana by way of Chicago. He opened GNR Hair Salon in Champaign's Campus Town area just in time for the return of University of Illinois students. It's a pretty slow morning, but Ansong says there's always a market for businesses like his around campus. Ray graduated from the U of I with a psychology degree, but also took courses in business and human resources. He and his brother Dennis sold cars for a while, but Ray says his real love was hairstyling. He did it at home for a time, and for a while at a J.C. Penney salon, but he wanted to style hair in his own salon. So Ray went back to school, this time, Concept College of Cosmetology in Urbana. Now Dennis Ansong is a student at Concept College and hopes to follow in his brother Ray's footsteps.
I've actually been told that if somebody had their last $5, $10, they would rather spend it on looking good, you know, whether it be buying shoes or clothes or doing their hair, you know, than actually going to buy food.
Janet Trosper owns and operates the cosmetology school, where classes are full and hopefuls are on waiting lists. She estimates about half her students are displaced workers.
Some of them never miss a day of school in order to get their license and go to work. And that says a lot when you're in school for almost a year, you know, 35 hours a week, and you never miss a day of school.
While the prospects for employment might be favorable for hairstylists, they're up in the air for a former Caterpillar employee from Decatur. But Eric Eskew says he and his family will ride out the city's financial troubles.
I really look for the economy to change. Caterpillar will be hiring again someday. Everything will change around and we'll be doing good. And so when I get out there, I just want to be like everybody else. I want to be ahead of the game instead of behind. And that's why I'm taking the classes here.
While his wife supports the family, Eskew is taking drafting and engineering design classes at Richland Community College, with financial help from the Federal Workforce Investment Act. It's been a long road for Rescue. He earned a business degree in the 80s, but says larger employers in Decatur, like Caterpillar and Archer Daniels Midland, weren't hiring then. Eric spent 15 years in retail and had to start up volunteering at Barton's, a Caterpillar supplier, in order to get back into manufacturing. It took 3 years at Barton's to get a job at Cat, which laid him off after just 9 months. Eric Eske was now 44 and wants a chance to use the creative side of his mind.
Go into the drafting side of it, maybe get off the floor a little bit, and then when you design these parts for them and stuff, go down and see how they turn out. Did they turn out the way you thought they were, or are they having problems with it? That's where I'd really like to go with it.
John Dahm is a professor of engineering technology at Richland. He admits having to raise morale in classrooms for professions that aren't producing jobs locally.
We do have to do missionary work. We do have to make the public aware that, you know, the health of our society is based upon being able to increase our productivity and be able to make things that we can sell at a higher price. And so I see myself evangelizing to lots of people about how important it is that we maintain these kind of jobs here.
Enrollment at Richland is up about 35% from a year ago. For example, one of Dahm's electronics classes would typically have about 6 students, but more displaced workers means 10 to 12 students per class period. Dahm says the college hasn't turned anyone away.
We work a lot of hours. You know, we've volunteer a lot of our time to keep things going. But I think most of us instructors here at Richland know that we're on a mission to really kind of save our community.
While family ties keep Eric Eske in Decatur, a Danville resident says he's going wherever the jobs are.
There's nothing wrong with continuing your education no matter what the age. I'm 52 years old. It makes me think about it a little bit, but it's no worry.
After 20 years working for UPS and 10 more at Heatcraft Refrigeration Products, Scott Priest is switching gears entirely. In the late 70s, he quit school after one semester at Danville Junior College. Scott decided architecture wasn't worth studying at a time when the job market was good in Danville. But after a decade making refrigeration units at Heatcraft, Priest was laid off last September. This week, he returns to his old junior college, now called Danville Area Community College. He hopes to land a part-time job while he studies computer networking.
You're a little trepidatious. You know, you think about it. It takes a little thought, you know, whether or not you're going to be able to jump right back on that horse after it's been 30-plus years since I've been to school. You know, but still, it's an opportunity. I love a challenge, and it's actually been kind of fun, and it's just falling right into place.
Chuck Jones coordinates grants for Vermilion County's Job Training Partnership Program, sending many displaced workers to the Danville Community College. He says the majority of his clients have been in manufacturing and related fields and feel nervous about studying something new. But he says many who do so gain a new sense of fulfillment.
Once they gain their education and finally move on to the field that they've chosen to do, you can tell that there's a sense of satisfaction and a sense of happiness, because instead of feeling forced to go do something because of a certain wage or a certain amount of money, now they feel like what they really have is a career and not just a job anymore.
And Jones says while his 400 or so clients look for new careers to get them through the recession, an influx of economic stimulus money is helping. He says the funding not only helps with tuition and fees, but also with areas like transportation and child care. I'm Jeff Bossert, AM 580 News.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our topic this afternoon in this portion of the program is looking for and landing a job. Our guest is Richard Nelson Bowles, the author of What Color Is Your Parachute? What Color Is Your Parachute? Job Hunter's Workbook, and now the author of a slimmer volume to jumpstart your search for a job titled The Job Hunter's Survival Guide. All of these books are published by 10 Speed Press. And our guest also has a website, jobhuntersbible.com. Questions this afternoon, listeners, about hunting for a job are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Richard Bowles, good to talk with you. How are you?
Just fine, Celeste.
Well, what are your thoughts about the story we just heard?
Well, first of all, I was very amused that it was Danville, Illinois, because I live in Danville, California. But you know, the issues you're talking about are the issues that everybody is wrestling with. That is, do I just try to keep finding the thing I used to do, and especially if I loved it, or do I set out in a new direction? And if so, what is that going to take?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think we're all confronting is the landscape is so changed.
Oh.
And so some people are thinking about retraining for a different kind of job. And this is where your book Parachute comes to mind, because in that book, it's so much about what values do you want to serve.
Yeah.
And here it's also in this new 100-page guide, the Job Hunter Survival Guide, where you say, you know, be ready to reinvent yourself. Where do you suggest people begin to think about discovering and building a work life with, in your words, meaning and purpose?
Well, it has to start with their doing a kind of self-inventory. We found out that people who try to skip that step and just, you know, listen to the possible options for their life and say, oh, that sounds interesting, maybe I should try that. These people who skip the self-inventory part don't do so well. The essence of what people do in their life that has them feeling satisfied always has to flow from who they are. What you do that is satisfying always flows from who you are. And people think that because they've lived a certain number of years with themselves, they know themselves very well, but that's why my book has sold 10 million copies,
yeah.
Because it doesn't pan out that way. And my book offers a kind of, this is Parachute, of course, the major book. It offers a way of their sitting down and doing a self-inventory of themselves over a weekend that will then enable them to make some intelligent choices about where they want to strike out and in what kind of a new direction.
Okay, and what kinds of things should we think about when we put this inventory together?
Well, the first one is, what are your favorite skills? Now, people always think, well, I should try to find out what it is I do best. In every survey that's been done over decades, it's turned out the person who loves to do something and maybe doesn't do it as well as the experts, let us say, but they love to do it, will triumph over somebody who has greater expertise in whatever area we're talking about but doesn't have much enthusiasm. It's the enthusiasm, the love of doing a thing that gives anybody who's looking for a re-entry into the job market the upper hand.
One of the things that you have, I know it's in the Job Hunter Survival Guide, and I haven't looked thoroughly at what color is your parachute lately, but the flower diagram, I think that our listeners can picture this. And this is a nice way to do, this fits in with the inventory.
Yeah.
If you think.
It is the inventory.
Right. If you think of a flower, you think of the center of the flower, and those are your transferable skills.
Right.
And then out from the center of the flower are six petals. What are those?
Well, the first one is geography. Where is it you want to work? Now, most people say, well, basically where I am. But occasionally somebody will say, well, I've always wanted to kind of pull up stakes and go and work in a different part of the country. And if so, they ought to put that on that particular petal. The next petal is special knowledges. That is to say, each of us is like a filing cabinet. We, in our heads, we have all kinds of information. We may know something about camping. We may know something about skiing. We may know something about various kinds of occupations we've been in the past. The question is, of those knowledges that you have stored up in your head, which are the ones that give you the greatest delight? Because if you work in a field that gives you great delight, you will always be happier and you'll also be more effective. The third pedal is, what kind of people do you want to be surrounded by? That means two things. One is the kinds of people you actually work with. Many a job has been killed by people not enjoying the people that they're working with, even though the work they were doing they thought they really, really would enjoy. And the other half of the people environment is the people you serve, the people that are your customers or your clients or whatever. The fourth pedal is serving what goals and purposes? What is it you're trying to do in that job and in that particular work? Are you trying to make the environment better? Are you trying to help people with their knowledge and their intellect? Are you trying to help people with their social achievements and making the priority being helping people to get well or helping people to learn more and that sort of thing? The fifth one is working conditions. Some people like to work outdoors. Some people like to work indoors. Some people like to work on a time clock. Some people like to work independent of a time clock. So this is a pedal where you put down what are the working conditions. Say you have two job offers down the line. You will decide between them mostly on the basis of the working conditions. So this asks you to think it out ahead of time. What are the working conditions I most favor and would be happiest achieving whatever it is I'm doing? And the sixth pedal is the responsibility and salary. What level do you like to work on? Do you like to be the boss? Do you like to be the member of a team? Do you like to work independently? That sort of thing. So those are the six pedals around the central one of what are your transferable skills? What are the things you do best or love to do the most with people or with data and information or with things?
And it's interesting to note here that you found that if you have a solid personal inventory, if you know who you are and you know what you value and what you like to do, what you're looking for, you have an 86% success rate at finding a job.
Right. That was a great surprise to me, I'll tell you.
Why is it so successful?
I really don't have a clue, but I only report what I find. I don't always report why that's so. I studied job hunting methods when I first came into this field back in the days when dinosaurs were roaming the earth. And one of the things I discovered was this one man in McLean, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C., who had this incredible success rate in helping people, and it was 86%. And I wondered why. So I arranged to go interview him. In fact, I moved to Washington, D.C. for 4 months so that I could interview him every day to try to find out what was the secret of the success of his clients. And it turned out to be they all took the time to do this self-inventory and to figure out not what was most marketable about themselves, what would sell best in the marketplace, but they tried to figure out what is it that would give them the greatest enthusiasm, what were the not just the best skills that I mentioned earlier, but the skills that they most enjoyed using. And it turns out to be sort of this was my off-the-cuff diagnosis. It turns out to be a kind of energy that when people are working with the things they most love to do, it gives them an energy to come in day after day and to perform at their highest level. And when they get interviewed to compete for various jobs in the beginning, their 86% success rate is because they come across as people who any employer would kill to have, people that really love the work and love what they're doing. And then I found, after I'd met him, his name was John Crystal, he died in 1988, but after I interviewed him, then I found out there were other people who had almost as high success rates. Nathan Azrin, who is still alive down in Florida, I mentioned him in the survival guide, and they all had the same high success rate, but it was based on their figuring out first, getting their clients, the unemployed who wanted reentry, to figure out first of all what is it they love the most to do and in what field do they love the most to do it.
Yeah. Well, I would say when I'm asked, well, who makes a good guest for a radio program, I would say someone with passion and knowledge. So that's
and most employers feel the same way.
Yeah, yeah. You gotta wanna, you know, come to the party to party. Come to play.
I say it again, Celeste. It's energy. It's, you know, picture a 60-year-old man, let us say, who is trying to find employment. Now, many employers will say, I'm not going to take on a 60-year-old employee because we're a large company. We have all kinds of health plans and stuff, and this guy is going to cost us. But there are places that will hire someone that age. They value their experience and other aspects of their being. So you picture two 60-year-old people going to compete for a job at this place that is open to hiring that age, and one sits slumped in his chair, his shoulders are kind of bent over in defeat. He's half sitting, half lying in the chair, and he's interviewing. And then you picture an alternative, which is another man who has done this kind of homework and is dying to be able to do this work, and he's leaning forward in his chair and so on. If you ask the employer later, why did you hire that guy rather than the one that just slumped in his chair, he sometimes will be inarticulate. The employer won't be able to say exactly why. But if he's a thoughtful person, he will say energy. It was the the second man conveyed a lot of energy, and I want to hire energy, not just expertise. Mm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Richard Bowles. He is the author of the classic What Color Is Your Parachute? It's helped generations of job seekers. Now the author has written a new, shorter and less expensive guide covering the essentials of looking for and landing a job in these very rough times. It's called The Job Hunter's Survival Guide, How to Find Hope and Rewarding Work Even When, quote, there are no jobs. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments about job hunting. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, if we have that inventory in hand, what other kind of strategies can we pull along with that to further increase our chances of success?
Well, what we've discovered over the years is that people really need to have, from the beginning, a mindset that says, I'm going to go for alternatives. Whatever I'm doing in my job hunt, I'm going to have an alternative way of doing that thing. For example, suppose you know exactly, after doing this inventory, you figure out exactly what kind of work you would love most to do, and you start to go job hunting to find that kind of a job. If you only send out resumes, let us say, you only have one strategy for searching for the kind of job you now realize you would love to do. Out of 100 job hunters, surveys have revealed that 51%, 51 out of the 100 will give up by the second month because they only have one way of going about that part of their job hunt. Whereas if they have two or more, up to four, that's an odd finding. They found if they have more than four strategies, they don't give the proper amount of time to each one. But up to four, more than one strategy, only 33 out of 100 give up on their job hunt by the second month. So you have to maintain hope when you're going about your job hunt. And the way to maintain hope is always to be sure that you have another way to go about the thing you're trying to do than just the one most obvious one, like sending out resumes. So that is an illustration of a general principle. It applies to all parts of the job hunt.
How long should someone expect to be out of work?
Well, currently, depressingly, the average is 20.1 weeks, and currently one out of every three job hunters has been out of work for more than 27 weeks.
Wow. You tell a story in the Job Hunter Survival Guide about losing a job as a young man. You were a husband and a father of four. What do you recall most vividly about that time in your life?
Well, I felt like I had a tremendous load of responsibility on my shoulders. I remember that so clearly because I was out of work earlier in my life when I was just married, and I didn't, and my wife worked, and so I didn't feel that kind of burden. But when you care about people and you know that they're depending on you, the sudden fact that you're out of work, especially if you didn't see it coming, I didn't even see this coming until 10 minutes before it happened, and I had four young kids, really young. I remember feeling so depressed and overwhelmed, and I went to see this dentist who had just come back from the funeral of Henry Luce, the founder of Time magazine, or the publisher of it. And I remember he had one of those little sticks with a mirror on the end that he looks in your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And this dentist waved this little stick right in front of my face to punctuate his points. And he said, "Someday you will say to yourself, this was the best thing that ever happened to you. I know you don't believe a word of what I'm saying now, but someday." Well, he turned out to be right, because after I did find a job working with college chaplains in nine Western states on behalf of the Episcopal Church, they all were out of work. They were all losing their jobs. And because I had been through the experience in my own life, I was hypersensitive to that issue, which I wouldn't have been if I hadn't gone through that same experience myself. So then I decided to try to help them. So I went out and did the research that formed the nucleus of, at that time, a 128-page book called What Color Is Your Parachute? So that's what I remember most vividly, that encounter with my dentist and his waving his little wand in front of my face to make the point that turned out to be so true.
Yeah. It did take you a while to find work, though, to find that job.
Oh, yes, it sure did.
Yeah, yeah. And you also say you made every mistake in the book.
Yes. The congregation, I was the canon pastor. I was an Episcopal minister at that time. I'm not now. But I was canon pastor of Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, which means I had two bosses. One was the dean of the cathedral, and the other was his boss, the bishop. And I just, I've forgotten what I was going to say. Say your question again.
You made mistakes in this job search.
Oh, yeah, with the mistake.
Yeah.
The congregation was up in arms because they liked me. I went out visiting families every evening and stuff like that. And so they held meetings and everything. And finally, they gave me a handsome purse that they said, "Use this to help yourself find another job." And I took that. I turned around and gave it to an executive counseling firm I won't name. And they took the money, and they sent out, I think, 1,900 resumes on my behalf, and I didn't get a single invitation to come in. And one of the members of my congregation was the personnel director for the University of California in Berkeley. And he and his assistant tossed a coin to see who would have to call me in and give me the bad news that my resume stunk. And so they told me all about that. So here I thought, by spending a lot of money and getting what I thought was professional advice and people who were in the know, I would have an inside track on finding a job. So that was the very first mistake I made. And I could tell you, if we had 2.5 hours, the other 89 that I made along the way.
Mm. Is there ever a time when seeking professional help is useful?
Yeah. The whole field of professional help has changed dramatically over the years. And now you have a lot of people who don't call themselves career counselors, which was the term in vogue for many, many decades. Now they call themselves career coaches. And they, if they're good career coaches, they define their role of how they can be helpful in a much more limited way. They say, "Tell me what are the problems you're running into, and I will help you find solutions to those problems." That's the technical definition of a coach. It's one who zeroes in on particular problems. Now, there's a directory in the back of Parachute, which has people who have asked to be listed there and who claim some competency with my book and so on. And so many job hunters start with the listings there. There's listings for Illinois and Indiana and every other state in the union. But you have to sort of ask some intelligent questions. So I tell people in the back of Parachute, I tell them what are the questions to ask when they're trying to figure out if this particular coach that they're thinking of hiring is going to actually be helpful to them.
Yeah. You talked a little bit a moment or two ago about the resume. And years ago, when I put out my first resume, I typed it on a manual typewriter and took it to a printer. Today, there is what you call the new resume. It's the internet.
Yep.
And there's a lot of stuff on the internet, good, bad, and ugly. How do we take advantage of the new resume, and how do we, if we've got problems with our new resume, typos, so to speak, how do you clean it up?
Well, if I were job hunting tomorrow, the first thing I would do would be to Google myself. This is the traditional approach that job hunters who are savvy are doing today. You go and ask Google to tell you every place your name appears on the internet, and you go to look to see what it says. If you're on Facebook, it'll pull that up. MySpace, it'll pull that up. YouTube, it will pull that up. And if you see anything there that you think to yourself, I really wouldn't want an employer to see this, you have to figure out how to remove that material or to put such a tight and effective password on it that people can't really get in to see it except whoever you designate. You don't want the employer to, I mean, what the internet offers to an employer is the equivalent of a private detective agency.
Mm-hmm.
And that is they can see every peccadillo you've ever done and so on, and they don't have to look that hard or that long in order to find it. And they certainly don't have to hire a detective. The Google search engine will do it for them. And so you have to clean up whatever you have there, but also you need to post some kind of a resume so that when the employer Googles you, and 55% of all employers now do this, according to the most recent surveys, when the employer Googles you, they're going to pull up your name, and you want one of the first things that they see to be your summary of what you most want an employer to know about you. So in spite of the fact that, in a sense, the whole internet is a resume of you, wherever you posted yourself or any of your friends have posted photos of you and that sort of thing, you still want to have a summary that will come near the top of the search engines when the employer Googles you, so that you will firmly fix in the employer's mind the picture of yourself that you want them to have.
Hmm. Besides the internet, are there other things you've seen in terms of changing how we look for, find work, and how employers find employees?
Well, the most interesting one to me is that jobs are much shorter in duration these days, much shorter. One time I was invited by this very prestigious center up in Canada. They had, if there was somebody who was number one on the bestseller list, they had them as their speaker within 2 months. And I was invited to come there and give a 5-day workshop on how to change careers. And nobody enrolled. And the owners of the place wrote me, and they were very chagrined. They said, everybody is talking about this. Why wouldn't they enroll? And I said, well, right now, career change is like scheduling a seminar on how to leave your wife. And I said, they feel like they should turn up with their raincoat turned up around their neck and their hat pulled low over their face to talk about changing careers. That's how much of a stigma there was in those days. This would be in the 1970s and early 80s, to changing careers. Now nobody thinks anything of it, so people are much freer to move around and to strike out in new directions, and that's a great blessing, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the messages that I heard in Jeff Bossert's report that we played at the outset today, yeah. There's people are resilient and creative, and with some sense of focus, they're on the road to, you know, they're on the road to finding a job.
Yeah. One interesting book has come out. It's authored by a friend of mine named Warren Farrell. And it's got tongue-in-cheek with its title. It's called Why Men Earn More. And he wrote the book for exactly the opposite reason. He wanted to teach women how to earn more. And when I first read the book, it came out about 3 years ago, I said to him, if I had my way, I'd give this to every woman that's thinking of reentering the job market. Because he talks about careers where women can make much more money than they would ever imagine. He talks about particular places that once you've settled on what you want to do, say you want to be a social worker, social work doesn't pay very well, generally speaking, and yet he's pointed to places where it pays very well. So he's put together this compendium of about 38 occupations where women earn more than men do in that occupation. And it's just an amazing bit of research that he did. And I think anyone who is concerned about their income level during this terrible, brutal time economically would do well to read that book and allow it to be a part of what they consider doing for their living.
And the title again is
Why Men Earn More.
Why Men Earn More. And the author...
It's a stupid title, but it was not his choosing.
That happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yes, it sure does.
And the author?
Warren Farrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L.
Okay.
And I think it's a McGraw-Hill book.
Yeah. Did you choose your title, What Color Is Your Parachute?
Yes. Yeah. I know it's an idiot title, too, but people remember it.
Well, it's, you know... It meant so much to me when I first picked it up back in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it works for people? Why do you think it's a classic?
I think somebody else other than myself should answer that question. But if I had to make guesses, I would say, first of all, it's both a visual book and a textual book. It doesn't just have print. It has cartoons and a whole bunch of things to appeal to the... left side of the brain and not just the right side, or the right side of the brain, not just the left. And secondly, I have a somewhat nutty sense of humor, which people either like or hate, but there's no such thing as a sacred cow that I won't make fun of. So for years, until this year, in fact, through the current one that's in the bookstore, I had a cartoon that said, you can name your own salary, here I call mine Fred. I always like anything that pokes fun at things in life. I'm a deeply religious man, but I think that one of the characteristics of living fully is that you see the sense of humor in everything, including about yourself, and so my book is filled with that. And then just word of mouth, you know, the book is, I've seen one advertisement for the book in my entire life. It's been out there now for 48 years. It's revised every single year, and so I sometimes kid my publisher. I say, I haven't published one book that sold 10 million copies. I've published 48 books hiding under the same title that have sold 10 million copies. Because I get a great kick out of rewriting it every year. And then I put out this little survival guide solely because I thought people may not be ready to read a thick book, and Parachute runs about 400 pages this year, and in the edition that's coming out in October, it's 300 pages. It's still formidable.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, why don't I go to my publisher and say, let's publish a small book. I'll write it from scratch. I didn't do boilerplate. I didn't just copy parts of Parachute into this survival guide. I I decided to write it from absolute scratch as in 100 pages, what are the most important things you think a job hunter should know? And I saw some statistics yesterday that said it's selling half as well as parachutes. So I think I was right that there was a demand for a book this thin and this inexpensive.
Yeah, yeah. I think the small book offers a lot of really good advice and hope. And, you know, if you're in this situation, it's, as you mentioned, when you were out of work for quite some time as a young man and a father of four kids, it's a burden.
Yeah.
And
it's one of the worst things that can happen to you in your life.
And, you know, if it's 100 pages, you can do that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you also are high on is getting sleep.
Yeah, well, that's because I'm 82 years old.
All of us, yeah.
No, I'm teasing.
Yeah.
I've become a monomaniac on that subject. I had an aunt who lived to be 97, and she was a physical education Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of Wisconsin. And yet, from the age she was 32, she took a nap every single afternoon. And she lived to be 97, and she always thought there was a connection. So when I found that out about her, I decided I would start taking a nap every afternoon, and have now for years. And then I studied the history of sleep, and there's an article on Wikipedia on the Internet called Segmented Sleep. And it tells about some interesting experiments where they gave people 14 hours and said, do what you want with it. And they found the first night they slept all the way through. But then the second and third and ever thereafter, they found they would sleep for about 4 hours. Then they would get up, they're awake, they would do conversation, they would do walk. This is historically in all cultures. Make love, do whatever they want to do. Then they go back to sleep and sleep another 4 or 5 hours. And that made all the difference in the world as to giving priority to sleep. Now, we have this myth since the invention of the electric light bulb that everyone should get 8 hours sleep every night. And if you don't, you should see a sleep specialist, which, of course, is nonsense. So I've become monomaniacal on the subject of, when people get out of work, one of the first things they should do is catch up on their sleep, because often they've been catching only 6 or maybe even 5 hours of sleep up to the time they bumped into this crisis. And the first thing they need to do is to be sure they've got the mental acuity and sharpness of their mind, which sleep gives you. I even talked my wife into taking a nap, and she was astonished at how much more alive she felt during the rest of the day. So this has become, I mean, I can joke with the next person as well as anyone about how silly it is that that should be such a simple secret, but I really do think it's terribly important.
Yeah. Here to wrap up, I would like to give our listeners some further really practical information. This comes from the Job Hunter Survival Guide. And this is advice that has to do if you're worried about, financial exhaustion. What advice do you have for folks who are concerned about, here's a big one, health insurance? You've got some really nice tips here.
Well, there are all kinds of sites on the Internet where you can go and find, you can compete for health insurance. My own wife has diabetes, and she was knocked out of a plan based on my job, so she had no health insurance. And she went around, just as one example, and she found out that here in the state of California, there is a special program where you can compete. You get your name on a mailing list. You have to send in a letter saying you've been rejected for health care elsewhere. They will put you in with the particular health plan that you want to be in, and they will subsidize it for that company for a while, and then the company has to take over. So she the Kaiser is one big HMO out here, and so she enrolled in that. So there are ways of doing research on the Internet to find what are the particular programs in your area whereby you may be able to compete or at least apply for and succeed in getting health insurance that wouldn't occur to the normal person. So I put those particular references in the survival guide.
www.healthinsuranceinfo.net.
Yep.
www.ehealthinsurance.com.
Yep.
And www.freelancersunion.org.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And there was an if somebody's a really good researcher, there was an article in the New York Times website this week by somebody that had done a lot of research on how you find health insurance, and it's a very good article.
Okay. Richard Bowles, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
I'm delighted, Celeste.
Take care. Best to you and your wife.
Thank you.
Richard Bowles is the author of the classic What Color Is Your Parachute? He's also now the author of the Job Hunter's Survival Guide, How to Find Hope in Rewarding Work When, quote, there are no jobs. The books are published by 10 Speed Press. Our discussion today, part of our summer-long project, Will Connect the Economy. We thank our community partners, First Call for Help Decatur, United Way of Danville, Family Service of Champaign County, and Community Service Center Rantoul. You'll find contact information for these agencies and others at our website, willconnect.org/economy.